So Moses is to go back to the land of Egypt, and the daunting task, as we turn to Exodus chapter 4, verse 1, Moses answered and said, but, now here the buts are starting to come, and he wasn't the only prophet to be a reluctant prophet. You go through the first few chapters of Ezekiel. Go, get thee to the house of Israel. Get thee to the house of Israel. And in the end he had to go, and he said, I went in the heat and bitterness of my spirit. And he thought, but when I get there, I'm not going to say anything. So he sat down, wouldn't say anything. And that was what it was like. He'd seen what had happened to Jeremiah back in Jerusalem. And no way did he want to be the prophet of God to his people. And in the end, God had said to him, you come out in the wilderness, I want a word with you, Ezekiel. And there was a talking to. And he said, you wouldn't say anything to them. Why no, Ezekiel? That's the way you want it, that's the way you'll have it. You wouldn't speak to them, so now you'll act my message. And from time to time, I will loose your tongue, and my people will flock to hear a dumb man speak. So, but there was a reluctant prophet. I think sometimes it's so easy to read, and the Lord said to Seth, so go and say, you know, very easy to say, but here it was. And so there's a but in this chapter 4 verse 1, but behold, they will not believe me nor hearken to my voice. They'll say, the Lord hath not appeared unto thee. Where have you been for 40 years anyway, Moses? Would be the sort of reception one would expect. Especially from Aaron. His kid brother. Deliverer. Living it up in the luxury for 40 years. And then what's happened to him? I don't know. Can't seem for dust and small mangled words. He's gone. You can imagine the sort of sarcastic comments from Aaron. They won't listen to me. So the Lord said to him, what's that in your hand? He said, a rod. So he said, cast it on the ground. And it did, and it became a serpent. Moses fled from before it. And then the Lord said, go up to it, take it by the tail. And it did, and it became a rod again. So he said, you show them that, that they may believe thee. And I'll show you something else, Moses said. Put your hand in, we'd say in your jacket today, put it into your cloak. And he did. And he pulled it out. He was leprous. He said, now put it in again. It was all right again. And he said, verse 8, it shall come to pass, they will not believe thee, neither hearken to the voice of the first sign, they'll believe the voice of the latter sign. Leprosy would make them jump. But if all else fails, verse 9, if they won't believe that, then take of the water of the river, pour it on the dry land, and it'll become blood on the dry land. Were these just sort of haphazard, I don't know, let's think of a sign, Moses, try this. Were they just haphazard signs? Each one no more wonderful than the other? I don't think so. Think of the three things. The serpent, leprosy, cleansing, the water and the blood. If we can't see a theme there, there's something wrong with us. A theme that runs through Scripture. These were no haphazard signs. And they should have meant something to the Hebrews. So, that but is dealt with. They won't believe it. God said, well, here are three signs. So that but was dealt with. Then verse 10, look at that one. Moses said to the Lord, oh my Lord, I'm not eloquent, neither heretofore nor since thou hast spoken to thy servants. But I am slow of speech and a slow tongue. What? mighty in word. In Acts 7, had Stephen made a mistake or something? Mighty in word was Moses. Well, what's all this then? I think, without wishing to bore you, for the one or two who are interested in the Hebrew here, perhaps if you just look at the Hebrew of these words here, suddenly it becomes clear what Moses is saying and the kind of excuse that he's making. When he says at the end of verse 10, I am slow of speech and of a slow tongue. Now, they're two different words, actually. They're both translated slow, but they're two different words in the Hebrew. The first one, I am slow of speech, is the word great. There are several passages we could look at. Let's just look at 2 Book of Kings, chapter 18. We'll only take one of each. The clock's going a bit too fast. Well, perhaps you think it's going too slowly, but if we just turn to 2 Book of Kings, chapter 18, we see where this word is used, and it gives some sort of feeling for what it means. Verse 17, the king of Assyria sent Tartan and Rabsaris and Rabshakeh from Lachish to King Hezekiah with a great host against Jerusalem. Those of you with margins there will see it says heavy, heavy, great, an army, an invincible army moving on its way. Not sort of skipping and jumping along, you know, it's that sort of great. That's the meaning of this word. It's translated slow in the verse we're looking at. I am slow of speech and of a slow tongue. Now, that, as we say, is another one. If you come to 1 Kings 12, there's an example of that word being used. 1 Kings 12 and verse 4, when Rehoboam comes to Solomon and says, thy father made our yoke grievous. Now therefore make thou the grievous service of thy father and the heavy yoke which he put upon us lighter. So that's the idea of this heavy or grievous, you know, something like that, bearing them down. So what was Moses saying? Incidentally, it's the same word that is used of several of the plagues. They came a grievous plague. They sure wore Egypt down. That is the meaning behind this word. So what was Moses saying? I'm a slow speech and a slow tongue. Moses was a reasoned, highly educated man, and his words were powerful. He could... the sort of man who at the AB meeting would carry all before him, you know, you couldn't argue with him, you see, like that. So what was he saying? I'm not eloquent, he said. And he was saying, for that crowd back there, those Hebrews, you need the slick politician type. You know? Well, I suppose it's the same in South Africa as it is in the UK. You know, we've got an election coming up. I'm glad I'm missing most of it. I'm very grateful. And all this slick talk, you know, the quick, you know, slick, clever talk, and getting people to go along with the Labour or the Conservative or whatever they are out here, and you know, all this rubbish. It's that quick, slick tongue that you want, Lord. Moses was a reasoned man, where if you sat down and talked with him, he would push his argument through. Slow, heavy. You don't want that kind of man, Lord. Now, that's what Moses is saying. It is interesting to see the answer that God gave to that objection, that but that Moses has raised. Verse 11, the Lord said to him, who hath made man's mouth, or who made the dumb, or the deaf, or the seeing, or the blind? Have not I the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be thy mouth, and teach thee what thou shalt say. And interestingly enough, the prophet, like unto Moses, stated categorically, he gave me a commandment, what I should do and what I should say, morning by morning, as he awakened Christ's ear that he might give him the tongue of the learned, that he might be able to speak a word in season to them that are so weary. Now here, God said, I'll tell you what to say, Moses. And then Moses has sort of run out of excuses, really. Verse 13. Oh, my Lord, send, I pray thee, by the hand of him whom margin thou shouldest send. There must be someone more appropriate than me. Why do you pick a man where you've got to tell me what to say? Surely there's someone that would be suitable, naturally speaking. Here am I, send him, you know? Misquote deliberately. But you do get quite a lot of that in the Brotherhood today. Here am I, send him. And what the Lord is looking for are the Isaiahs of this world. Here am I, send me. You know, in ecclesial life, what are they going to do about it? You know, well, it's a good idea to say, what can I do about it? And so now Moses is saying, well, there must be someone more appropriate to send that one. Verse 14, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. In other words, God has listened to these excuses now, and what have we got? This is excuse number 5, and he becomes angry now. We should not push the patience of the Almighty too far. And he said, is not Aaron the Levite thy brother? I know that he can speak well. And in the context, that tells us a bit more about Aaron, doesn't it? He is the sort of chap that can talk, but he wasn't a powerful, weighted argument of command that Moses' younger brother was. And fairly quick footwork sometimes, had Aaron, sidestepping problems when they arose. I know that he can speak well. And also, behold, he cometh forth to meet thee. And then he gives Moses a sign. And when he seeth thee, he'll be glad in his heart. Well, a funny thing to say, wouldn't it? If his brother had been away from home for 40 years, he'd have expected him to be glad in his heart. Or would you? In this case, clearly the inference is no. That would be the least thing that you'd expect. My kid brother lived it up for those 40 years, and now he's coming back. A bit late, aren't you, Moses? You know, where have you been? We've had another 40 years of slavery thanks to your scarpering like that. Would have been the sort of human reaction one would have expected. But Aaron was going to be glad. And clearly this was not to be expected, or else it wouldn't have been a sign, would it? I mean, if someone said to me, Peter, there's a sign when you get back to England, your wife's going to be glad to see you. I said, well, I hope she is. You know? It wouldn't be a particular sign to me of anything, really. But here, this was a sign to Moses. And there's something else odd in that verse 14. Now, let's skim through the verses too quickly. Is not Aaron the Levite thy brother? Whatever did God say that for? Why didn't he just say, Aaron's thy brother, isn't he? Why this title, Aaron the Levite? Well, we know that one day the Levites were going to be set on one side for the service of God. Yes, we know that, but that hadn't happened yet. But Aaron the Levite picked him out as a character well known to whom people would come with their questions and so on. Aaron the Levite, he's your brother, isn't he? I mean, I haven't got a brother, I've got a sister, and if someone said, Pauline the English woman, that's a funny thing to say, of course she's English. So why Aaron the Levite? Did he think that Moses had forgotten which tribe his brother was of or something? So it is quite obvious that Aaron was someone well noted, Aaron the Levite. And his younger brother, his kid brother, was going to come back with a message that would make it very hard for Aaron the Levite to accept of his younger brother. And we look on now to see what the message was. Anyway, he was going to be glad in his heart. You get another case of this, come to think of it, don't you? You remember when Jacob deceived his old father Isaac, and his brother Esau said, "Once my father's dead, I'll kill him for what he's done." And Jacob fled, and he was away for half as long, wasn't it? Just 20 years. And he says to God, "I fear to meet my brother," because his own servant said, "Oh, Esau's coming to meet you. He got 300 men with him," which wasn't so good. And Jacob said, "I fear my brother." When Esau came up, he fell on his neck and kissed him. He was glad to see him. And Jacob couldn't say, but "My Lord," he says to his brother, "have this present." You know, he couldn't sort of give him the stuff fast enough. Esau says, "All right, I've got plenty, thanks, you know, and don't need it." He said, "Oh yes, please have it before," because he said, "I saw thy face as it had been the face of God, and thou wast pleased with me." And through the smiling, welcome face, he saw the smiling face of God, as it were. And sometimes the cause of the greatest fears in life can be seen to be the hand of the Lord working. Those men that were terrified of that was coming across the Galilean waves in the early hours of the morning towards them. "Be of good cheer, it is I." And in the very thing that they feared was the Lord. In Esau's face, Jacob saw, smiling through, the Lord. And in our lives too, so often that which we fear, which we can become at our wit's end with, working in it, is the Lord. And the Lord will work in strange ways sometimes in our life, not the ways we would have chosen, as he forms his jewels, which one day he will gather together. Well, here now, Moses was to go back, and this was to be a sign. Aaron was going to be pleased to see him. But it's the next bit, isn't it? Verse 15. "And thou shalt speak unto him, and put words in his mouth, and I will be with thy mouth, and with his mouth, and will teach you what ye shall do." That's plural. It's one of the ways which the dear old Authorized shines out, isn't it? The thousand, the you, should be told, which is plural and which is singular. Verse 16. "And he shall be thy spokesman unto the people, and he shall be to thee instead of a mouth, and thou shalt be to him instead of God." And now here we see the position that the Almighty is putting Moses in. And you to take your rod and do these various signs. So he goes, Moses now goes back. He's run out of excuses now, and he can see that he's angered the Lord by the excuses. And so, with no further ado, he goes back to Jethro. And it's clear that he was pretty out of touch. Verse 18, he says, "Let me go, I pray thee, and return to my brethren which are in Egypt, and see whether they're still alive." So in these 40 years, he pretty well lost contact. And Jethro said, "Go in peace." So the Lord said to Moses, "Go, return into Egypt, for all the men are dead which sought thy life." Particularly, of course, Ramesses II. And this other upstart was now on the throne. And, of course, in reverse, you've got the parallel in the case of the message that came to Joseph to take Christ back out of Egypt. So here he's to go back into Egypt, Moses is. verse 20, Moses took his wife and his sons. So although the birth of the firstborn has been described, it is quite clear that the second son has also been born, that we looked at in the 18th chapter. So there are two sons. And he's got to go back and Zipporah, I don't think was our keen on this business, reading as it were between the lines, and I confess that's what I have done. I think she thought that in this there was something of a wild goose chase. Going what? Tell the great Pharaoh of Egypt to let all his free slaves. You're joking. Anyway, Moses took his wife and his sons. And God said in verse 21, do these wonders before Pharaoh, but I will harden his heart that he shall not let the people go. Free will? Where was the free will of Pharaoh? Right at the outset, God says, I'll harden his heart so that he won't let them go. Well, the reason we mention this here is that you'll notice that right at the outset, God says, I will harden his heart. But we shall look at that in a little more detail as we proceed with the chapters. And verse 22, thus saith the Lord, Israel is my son. And there was going to be that wonderful phrase, out of Egypt have I called my son, with all its antitypes and so on. We know them well. Israel is my son, even my firstborn. Let my son go, that you may serve me. If thou refuse to let him go, behold, I will slay thy son, even thy firstborn. So at the outset, before ever a river had been turned into blood or anything, the chips were down. And God led up to the climax of the slaying of the firstborn. What a stubborn man. You'd have thought by the time they got to number 7, he'd have thought, well, you know, this is going on. And he did say, God would demand my firstborn. But he didn't. Incredible man. And so Moses goes. Here now the faith of the prophet is accepting the will of God, and he's going, and possibly a reluctant wife and his two sons. Verse 24, it came to pass by the way in the inn that the Lord met him and sought to kill him. Now some people, embarrassed at this, say, well no, what it means is one of his sons, but it doesn't say that. He met him and went about to kill him. And obviously words must have been exchanged, because Zipporah knew what the bone of contention was. And so she took a sharp stone and circumcised her, note the word, son, singular. But we've just been told that there were sons. So both sons were with them. She circumcised one in a fit of paddywhack, and cast the foreskin at Moses' feet and said, surely a bloody husband art thou to me. She'd no patience with this. And it becomes fairly obvious that the first son, Moses faithfully had insisted on being circumcised. And Zipporah, at the birth of the second one, said, oh, we're not having this nonsense, you know. And there must have been some sort of argument. And Moses, to stop the boat rocking, as it were, in the family, must have given way, because Zipporah here knows jolly well what the trouble is. And faced with Hobson's choice, rather than seeing her husband slain, she carries out the circumcision of the one son, presumably the second son. And in Scripture, there's a little phrase, brethren, because thou hast hearkened to the voice of thy wife. Now, sisters, don't be angry that I mentioned that phrase. It came with Adam, Abraham. You know, they listened to the voice of their wife. In the case of Abraham, it's particularly interesting that we tend to look upon these characters as sort of artificial. They weren't. They were men and women with like passions as ourselves. And when Abraham listened to the voice of his wife Sarah, and a child was begotten by Hagar, and so Abraham's gone along with the idea of his wife, and then Hagar despises Sarah because she knows that now she's expecting, and Sarah turned around to Abraham and said, my fault be upon thee, your fault, you shouldn't have listened to me. Can't help thinking of little domestic scenes, but that they were normal people with like passions as ourselves. But there was that expression, because you've listened to the voice of God. Now here, it seems fairly obvious that Moses had listened to the wife of his wife Zipporah, and he shouldn't have done. And the Lord went about to kill him. That's a bit drastic, isn't it? Couldn't the Lord have said, Moses, you haven't circumcised your second son? Couldn't he have said that? Why this drastic action? Moses had to learn a very important point here. It was a point that cost him a lot when subsequently, in anger, he overlooked it. And that was that type matters, symbol matters. They're not just given as God's sort of thinking something for them to do. It matters. When the tabernacle, the structure and the dimensions was given, God said to Moses, you see to it, Moses, that you make it after the pattern that was shown you in the mount. Type mattered. And when God made that covenant with Abraham, he did not say, and if you feel like it, circumcise your son. It was a command. It was a type of the cutting off of the flesh. This was to be a separate people, separated for God, and it mattered. So this point is being got clear to Moses right from the start. In this great task that you're going to do, remember this, Moses, that type matters. And it has to be as I say. And Moses was brought up with a jolt. Infant sprinkling won't do. It has to be baptism, a burial in water. Type matters. It is not an irrelevance. So, right at the outset, we've got that clear. Verse 26, so the angel let him go. Then she said, a bloody husband thou art because of the circumcision. There was something else that happened that didn't happen, isn't told us here. Huh? Oh yes, there was quite a little family tiff here over this, and the sort of comment I suppose that Zipporah must have made was, well, if this is your God getting to go on a wild goose and then you're doing it and he goes about to slay you, I've had enough, I'm going back. Thinking that she had played what I suppose the ladies might call the ace of trumps. Then Moses played the ace. Very well, Zipporah. You go back. I am going on. And if you turn to chapter 18, when the news got round that after all Moses had done it, he brought them all out, it had happened against all odds, and it spread like wildfire even before the days of television throughout the surrounding nations that this had happened just as God intended that it should. And Zipporah, coming to learn of this, must have sobbed to her old father. She had thrown away her prince. Foolish woman. Why had she allowed that paddywhack to get the better of her? Why hadn't she been more faithful? And the understanding old Jethro says, come along, my dear. We can put this right. Marvellous man Jethro was. Verse 1 tells us they all heard that it had happened against all odds. And then verse 2, then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her back, and her two sons, and then we give him the names of both of them. Verse 5, and Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife unto Moses into the wilderness, where he encamped at the mount of God. So there, Moses had sent her back. Right, O Zipporah, you go back. I'm going on. And, you know, one or two brethren said to me, very sorry Sister Jackie couldn't come. Well, yes, so was Sister Jackie. She'd love to have met you, but it does make it, and this is easy, this is just chattering about the things that we love with friends. I mean, that's easy. Moses, look at what he had to do without his wife by his side. And when Israel went to their tents initially before they got to Sinai, Moses was alone. He was a man who could stand alone. That's why he was the chosen vessel that he was. And he was going to have to stand alone as well. Then, verse 27, the Almighty sent an angel to Aaron, go into the wilderness to meet Moses. And he went and met him in the Mount of God, and he kissed him. And as we've already dealt with it, there was the sign. Note the words in the next, these words here, they're so pregnant with meaning. Verse 28, Moses told Aaron, note the next word, all the words of the Lord who had sent him and all the signs which he'd commanded him. All the words? Wouldn't it have been a little bit tactful, a little bit discreet to have missed out some of the words, like verse 16, the end of the verse, he shall be to thee instead of a mouth, and thou shalt be to him instead of God. No, all the words. And so the kid brother here says to his older brother that God had told him that he, Moses, was to be as God to his older brother Aaron. Well, it had to be said. But more was to come. Verse 29, the two brothers went and gathered together all the elders of the children of Israel, and Aaron spoke all the words. So Aaron publicly, before all the elders of Israel, had to say, this, my younger brother, has to be to me instead of God. Hard, you know, for an older brother. I don't know whether older brothers here, and how you got on with your kid brothers when they were younger, but, you know, hard to do. Loss of face. Aaron the Levite had to say that to the elders of Israel. Verse 31, the people believed. Now they rejoice that God's looked on their affliction. They bow their heads and worship. Now, when things are looking good, it is then that it is so easy to worship God, when things are going well. And sadly, here is the start of a long catalogue of when things were going well, they worshipped, they sang praises. When things were going the other way, they stopped worshipping. And in our lives, brethren and sisters, however hard it is, we must believe that all things, the good and the bad, work together for good, ultimately, to those who love and fear Him. And thank God for all things, and not be selective. Very hard. Israel just couldn't seem to learn this lesson. They worshipped when things were going well, sing praises and so on. When things were going the other way, they weren't quite so forthcoming. And that won't do. So, chapter 5, in they go to Pharaoh and say, we've no choice in this, Pharaoh. We've got to go. And Moses had never met this man before. He's a stranger to him. And he said, we've got to go. End of verse 3, lest he fall on us with pestilence or with the sword. You notice? Moses got the message when that angel met him in the inn. When God says it's to be, it will be, or else. We've got to go. And we know chapter 5 pretty well. You're just making excuses. Cut off the straw supply. Go and get your own stubble and stuff. And why has the number of bricks gone down? And the taskmasters started flogging them harder to get the same output. It sounds like the UK industry today, actually. All this diminishing of the labour force, and you still expect it to get the same. It's, you know, history repeats itself, doesn't it? Well, for those of us who've come under the rod, this is what it was like, except that perhaps we weren't making bricks without straw. And when Moses came out with Aaron, verse 20, they met Moses and Aaron, who stood in the way, and they said unto them, the Lord look on you and judge, because you've made our savour to be a board in the eyes of Pharaoh and the eyes of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to slay us. How fickle. 1 minute worshipping. Now look what you've done, Moses. And Moses returned to the Lord and said, Lord, wherefore hast thou so evil entreated this people? Why is it that thou hast sent me? So even Moses is baffled. He thought he was just going to go, whoop, just straight through like that. Bit of an argument, because God had said he would harden Pharaoh's heart and then it would all come right. Not a thing has happened. It's not a single miracle, and they're a dash sight worse off. How do we get on when reversals come, as reversals do? These verses are packed with exhortation, aren't they, my dear brethren and sisters? And so Moses has come back to God in his bewilderment. And I want you to notice now how God builds Moses up. What is the means whereby he does it? Does he send along a whole host of angels? The flames of fire in the bush. He said, all right, Moses, there's plenty behind you. And he said, no. What does he do? Just notice the recurring phrase. Verse 2. God said to Moses, I am the Lord. Verse 6, say to the children of Israel, I am the Lord. Verse 7, you shall know that I am the Lord. The end of verse 8, I am the Lord. You see that little refrain running through it. I will be that I will be, and nothing will stop it. And that is the exhortation to Moses, which he has to pass on to the Hebrews. Verse 3, I appeared unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob by the name of God Almighty, El Shaddai, Mighty One of the Mighty Ones. Well, yeah, that's true. El Shaddai, Mighty One of the Mighty Ones. Yes, it's absolutely true. But just reading our authorized version, he goes on then, but by my name Jehovah, or Yahweh, he who shall be, was I not known to them. What? Abraham, the friend of God, didn't know his memorial name. And it used to bother me as a lad, this verse did. Oh, my, Abraham, the friend of God, didn't know. Well, but apparently, now I'm no Hebrew scholar, but apparently here there is at the end of this verse the actual structure of the Hebrew allows for it to be a question or a statement. There is a tiny little mark, I think it looks like a little, you know, in the Hebrew, a little tiny mark where we've got a question mark. But its absence in the Hebrew does not preclude it being a question. So now we'll alter the expression of the voice. I appeared unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob by the name of God Almighty. But Moses, by my name Yahweh was I not known to them. There's something more than that. And I humbly suggest that this should be read with that expression as being in the form of a question. Not only Mighty One of the Mighty Ones, but I will be that I will be he who will be. And that had stood Abraham in such good stead. And you, Moses, are to take note of this, and you to tell the Hebrew elders this, and this is what is to carry you through. So, verse 7, I will take you to me for a people, and I will be to you a God. And you shall know that I am the Lord your God, which bringeth you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And I will bring you into the land. Nothing and no man, certainly not Pharaoh, would stop it. It would go forward, this plan. You see the whole tenor of the exhortation here. And God doesn't change. And there's a day and an hour set, and he will send Christ back to the earth. Oh, it's been a long time, 2,000 years. And some are growing weary, and some are becoming patient. Nothing's happening, isn't it? So, verse 9, Moses spoke to the children of Israel, and they didn't listen. Moses had listened, he got the exhortation, but he was unsuccessful in passing it on. So go now, speak with Pharaoh. You've had this exhortation, Moses, now get into Pharaoh and tell him to let the children of Israel go. Behold, verse 12, the children of Israel have not hearkened unto me. Whatever makes you think, Lord, that an Egyptian's going to hearken to me? How then shall Pharaoh hear me, who am of uncircumcised lips? Let's just turn Isaiah's passage up, shall we? Isaiah chapter 6. Verse 5. He's seen this wonderful vision. I saw also the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up. In later years, and I, if I be lifted up, will draw all men unto me. This spake he, says John, signifying by what death he should die. And so here Isaiah sees the Lord on a throne, coupled with high and lifted up, and in Revelation as the eternal prospect, John was given to see upon the throne the Lamb. These two ideas run together through Scripture. And so he's given this great vision. There isn't time to dwell on that, but verse 5, he says, "Woe is me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for mine eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Then flew one of the seraphim, having a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with the tongues from off the altar, and he laid it upon my mouth, and said, "Lo, this hath touched thy lips, and thine iniquity is taken away, and thy sin is purged. Now who will go for us?" Then said I, "Here am I, send me." And Isaiah was only too well aware of his unworthiness. "I am a man of unclean," or uncircumcised, what word you like, lips. And we see this same spirit shown in Moses. "I who am of uncircumcised lips." But he goes in to Moses, to Pharaoh. Verse 30, we're reminded of what Moses said, "Behold, I am of uncircumcised lips, and how shall Pharaoh hearken to me?" The Lord said to Moses, "See, I have made thee," now he had made him a god to Aaron. Now he says, "I've made thee a god to Pharaoh. And Aaron thy brother shall be thy prophet." And then here we have it in verse 3. "I will harden Pharaoh's heart." Now, there are those who are worried by this. In the days of the Apostle Paul, there were those who worried. Let's just keep a finger in Exodus. Let's just go to the Apostle's argument in Paul's letter to the Romans, because I think this is helpful in seeing how God deals with the sons of men. We won't deal with the example in Romans 9 verse 10 of Jacob and Esau, because time is pressing on, but we will come to verse 17. "The scripture saith unto Pharaoh, even for this same purpose have I raised thee up," and we shall be looking at this verse together, "that I might show my power in thee, that my name might be declared throughout all the earth." And at a first reading, it almost makes it look as though God was treating Pharaoh like a sack of potatoes, some inanimate object, you know. And "I've raised thee up so that I might show in thee my power." And he hardened Pharaoh's heart, you know. Verse 18, "Therefore hath he mercy on whom he will have mercy, and whom he will, he hardeneth." And the Apostle Paul anticipates the objection. Verse 19, "Thou wilt say unto me, why doth God yet find fault? For whoever hath resisted his will," poor old Pharaoh, what chance did he stand, you know? And he anticipates the natural reaction to this. If God was going to harden Pharaoh's heart, that he might show in Pharaoh his power, wasn't that a bit hard on Pharaoh? Verse 21, "Hath not the potter," verse 20, "Nay, but O man, who art thou that repliest against God?" Yes, but he doesn't get rid of the little ripple underneath, does it? All right, you can't answer God back. "Shall the thing formed say to him that formed it, why hast thou made me thus? Hath not the potter power over the clay of the same lump to make one vessel to honour and another to dishonour?" The answer to that is, well, yes, of course he could. He's almighty, he's all powerful. But where's free will in that? And so he made Pharaoh, then, one might think, from a superficial reading, into this horrible type that he was, so that he could show his power in him. But where was free will in that? And this example of a potter working on the clay, you know. Well, the clay doesn't have a chance, does it? The answer is in the previous chapter of Romans. If we go back to chapter 8, and just work backwards, would you, from the end of verse 30. Just go backwards. "There are certain people that God is going to glorify, right? Them he also glorified. Who are those? Come back up the verse. It's those people that are justified, counted as righteous by God. Oh, and who's he going to count as righteous? Come back up the verse. Those that he calls. No man comes to me, said Christ, except the Father which has sent me draw him, and I'll raise him up at the last day, and he'll be glorified, right? So they're the ones that he calls. Oh yes, well, who's he going to call then? Verse 30. Those that he did predestinate. You've gone round in a circle. Oh, we're back where we started now. He's decided he's going to be in the kingdom, so he calls them and justifies them, and then he glorifies them. Where's the free will? But we haven't gone back far enough. Verse 29, from the front of the verse this time. Whom he did foreknow, he did predestinate. Ah, so the beginning of this chain is not predestination at all. The beginning of the chain is foreknowledge. And because of foreknowledge, he can predestinate with absolute justice and equity. What is foreknowledge? Well, I know when I was a little lad at Sunday school, quite a long time ago, they said, well, Peter, it's like this, you know. It's like a mother who's got two young sons, as Billy and Johnny, and Billy loves chocolates, and Johnny doesn't like, and they make him feel sick. And she knows that if she says to her two sons, hey, well, I'd like to be a good lad, have a chocolate, Billy will say, oh, thank you, Mummy, you know. And Johnny will say, no thanks, Mum. And there you are, you see, that's foreknowledge. That's absolutely wrong. It's got nothing to do with it at all. That is not a demonstration of foreknowledge at all. What that is an intelligent guess based on past experience. Because there could come a day when Billy said, oh, I don't know, Mom, I don't feel too grand today, I won't, thanks. And Johnny says, you know, I've been saying no for years. Perhaps I've got to lie, I'll try one, you see. It's gone wrong. Foreknowledge cannot go wrong. So that wasn't foreknowledge. So that's quite a wrong example. So if you were taught that when you were in Sunday school, forget it, because it's wrong. And if you're a Sunday school teacher, scrap that out of the curriculum and don't give it. That is not foreknowledge. Instead, we'll give another little parable. Now, in these days of time machines and all this clever stuff, use your imagination a bit. Let us just suppose that we could climb onto our time machine and pedal back till we get to the time of, I'm not much good at history, just before the Battle of Trafalgar. South Africa's all heard about that, haven't they? We're all right, aren't we? So, Battle of Trafalgar, you know, the English and the French, bang, bang, you know. Anyway. We get to go back to that time, and we come to the French port, and we say bonjour, you know, whatever French. If you go into this battle, you'll lose. Don't be silly. Get out of my way. We've got bigger ships than the English, and they had. That's why they lost. Actually, we've got bigger ships than the English. Ridiculous, minor, stupid man. And off they go to the Battle of Trafalgar. And what's left of the French fleet comes limping back. They said, where's that man with that book? You know? And they come to him and they say, why did you make us lose that battle? And I said, I didn't make you lose the battle. It's just here in my history book that you lost it. I'm just telling you what was there. I didn't make you lose it. I didn't make you go. It'd been a good idea if you'd stopped at home, like I said, but there it is. That is foreknowledge. You'd be quite right. You didn't make that French fleet go. You didn't make them lose even. You were just telling them what was in your history book. And you, in that rather far-fetched little parable, would have been much in the same position as the prophets of God. God, with his foreknowledge, was able to tell them what had happened. Foreknowledge, knowing before. Now, God, in addition, of course, can contrive to make the French lose the battle and so on. That's in addition. But the foreknowledge, we want to limit this just to the foreknowledge. The foreknowledge in no way affects the person's free will. God in advance knows what that person, of their own free will, has made of their lives. And therefore, knowing that beforehand, he can decide their destiny with absolute equity. Why wait so that mortals can see that it's happened when he knows before? Of course he can decide their destiny or predestinate them with absolute equity. Now, of all the attributes of God, many of them he's given to us. Thus, God can love, we can love. He can hate, we can hate. And so on and so forth. But the foreknowledge that God has is utterly, absolutely, and completely missing in us. We just have not got foreknowledge. All we can do is to say, well, the prophet has said this, so we believe that it will happen. We have not got of ourselves foreknowledge. It's utterly missing in us. And therefore, it is a matter of faith that we must accept that God has this foreknowledge. Now, he, knowing beforehand the rapscallion that this Pharaoh chap was, saw to it that that rascal moved the chess piece across, was on the throne of Egypt just at that time. But he didn't make him that wicked, stubborn man he was. And so when it says he hardened his heart, it does not mean to say that Pharaoh, like some robot, you know, had to turn into a nasty person. It does not mean that at all. Some have become a little embarrassed by these. Let's go back to Exodus. Having seen the Apostle Paul's explanation, let's go back and apply it. If we come back to Exodus, there have been one or two embarrassed ways of trying to sort of, well, you see, it's like this. Pharaoh started off hardening his own heart, and eventually God said, well, I might as well harden it for him. But if we look at the text, it just doesn't stand up. I mean, we've seen that right at the outset, God says, harden his heart. Right at the outset. And, well, just let's look at one or two in a little bundle. Let's look into the 8th chapter. Look at chapter 8 and verse 32. There it says, Pharaoh hardened his heart. Chapter 9, verse 12. The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh. Chapter 9, verse 34. He sinned yet more and hardened his heart. So Pharaoh's hardened his heart. And the heart of Pharaoh was hardened. Chapter 10, verse 1. Go in unto Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart. And you see what's happening? Just ricocheting from one to the other. So that argument doesn't stand up. It'd be a nice one if he did, but it doesn't. The text will not support it. Then there's a bit more learned kind of explanation. They said, well, when God hardened the heart, it was the word chazak in the Hebrew. And when Pharaoh hardened his own heart, then it was the word kabeh, you see. Unfortunately, that also would be a very good argument if it was true, but the text doesn't stand up to it. Let's just look again at a simple example. Look at chapter 9. This where we've got to. That'll be good enough. Verse 34, when Pharaoh saw that the rain and the hail and the thunders were ceased, he sinned yet more and hardened his heart. So that's Pharaoh doing the hardening, right? I'm trying to remember this. I know it's a bit difficult, especially before dinner. That's the word kabed. So we say, right, Pharaoh hardened his heart, that's kabed. Verse 35, so the heart of Pharaoh was hardened. And who'd just done it? Pharaoh is the word kabed. But in verse 35, unfortunately, is the word chazak. So we sort of come a pearl straight away with that idea. And then chapter 10, verse 1, Moses said, go into Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart, and that's the word kabed again. So it ricochets from one to the other. It is true to say that in most cases, when God did the hardening, it was chazak, and when Pharaoh did the hardening of heart, it was kabed. But that's not good enough to categorically state that this was the case. So you say, all right, smart Alex, so you've tossed two ideas out of the window. Now what is it then? Well, why is there this I pardon, Pharaoh's pardon? Why is it? How does it work? I think always it is better. I mean, we can sort of spend hours and hours poring over Hebrew lexicons and everything, but sometimes I think it's a much better shortcut to let scripture answer scripture. And quite, or even more satisfactory, turn to the first book of Chronicles. And chapter 10. Here at the end is the end of the life of Saul, the son of Kish. We know the account well, we won't go into great detail. He was wounded by the Philistine archers, and verse 4, then said Saul to his armor bearer, draw thy sword and thrust me through, lest these